This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 347, August the 18th, 1978, side two. There was something revealing in the Bob Green interview that he had with Patty recently. And this is also another reason I think her life is in danger, is that the amnesia that she had for a while, she couldn't remember anything after the Hibernia Bank, and she had a period of amnesia, which also is characteristic of Charlie Bates saying, we'll put her into a hospital as soon as we arrest them and put her in a hospital, because that's where the amnesia takes place, and then she can forget to testify against the two people who kidnapped her, and then they're assured their release. If Patty is killed, or if Patty acts mentally disturbed, or if she has amnesia, then people are ready to believe that she can't account for her own kidnapping. There's this barrage of propaganda on radio station in San Francisco, KGO, where they talk all the time, and the moderators talk, and people call in and say, well, how would she know what happens? We don't believe her, or maybe she knew them, or she's covering up a lot, and it's just Patty against the Harrises. And they never go in very much in depth on the fact that she was in a closet 54 days and tied by the wrist and indoctrinated the first week solely by Donald DeFries, a prisoner. And after Patty was kidnapped and after I wrote my article, then she went into the details when she came home and about being kept in the closet and Donald DeFries talking to her for 1 week. Well, a girl like Patty Hearst, who's gone to private schools all of her life, who's been a sheltered, very wealthy white woman, you know, isn't used to being with a black prisoner who's bragging about killing Dr. Marcus Foster or being with people with machine guns or living the life of an informer. He worked the Los Angeles Police Department, and up till that time he had years of crime and bank robberies and attempted shootings, attempted murders. He was charged with a kidnapping down there. It's very fearful for her. And here he is wearing guns and saying they'll blow her up for 1 week, and then being read Blood in My Eye, a book about George Jackson, and knowing that he also was killed in the prisons, and indoctrinated with a lot of guilt for being rich and a victim of their circumstances, and being told that she's there. She's been rich and that society is ripped off, and that she feels she has to pay her dues for being Patty Hearst. And so she has a combined fear and guilt, plus the suggestion on one of the tapes. I have a tape of her first radio contact where she said, I'm all right, I have a cold, and they gave me a pill. Well, just the word pill could change her life forever. I know one acid in 1967, given by Carolyn Gilman to my son Marvin Goodwin, has caused its 11 years of agony, sometimes bliss and clear head, and sometimes sheer agony and regression. And these monsters have created these pills, so anything that you get for a cold can affect you the entire rest of your life. And I think Patty has to realize that, too. But she said in this article, I wouldn't work for a newspaper. She said they created the image, and here's a newspaper heiress, of a person that isn't her at all, as Patty or Tanya. She said, I wouldn't work for a newspaper for anything. I don't blame the public for anything. The newspapers and the government are what I blame. Now, when she says she blames the government, then Patty Hearst, of course, is in danger. And the thing is that Randolph Hearst wants to appeal, and the man that Patty's in love with and the committee want to appeal to the kindness of Jimmy Carter for clemency. If the government was involved, even though I had worked for them, like Randolph Hearst has done and Catherine Hearst, for many years, I would scream and yell and ask for a thorough investigation. If she knows that the government has played a part in causing her this pain and killing these other six people in these costly trials and the burning of property and terrorizing neighborhoods and creating 22,000 extra FBI men and breaking into hippie communes and knocking down doors. There was a case of a girl that was supposed to be housing Patty Hearst back east, and the FBI came in and broke down the place and terrorized her. And she got a settlement, I think it was around $15,000. for what happened. And last week the judge took it back and said, well, we changed our mind. You can't have it. And she's going to take it to the Supreme Court. And she's screaming back there, what right have they? It's like Nazi Germany, she said. So Patty Hearst is blaming the newspapers, even though she's a newspaper heiress, for creating a personality that she isn't, and also the government. And as I say, that's why Patty is in danger. Now, I have a copy here from the New York Times. In September 30th, 1976, I wrote my article in 74, 2 years earlier, came out in the fall of 74. The Harrises are indicted in the kidnapping of Miss Hearst. Now, can anyone tell me why the Harrises haven't been tried for kidnapping in 2 years? I really would like to know. And why their trial is going to come up at a time when Patty is in a prison nearby with two known federal agents, God knows how many there are in that prison besides Patty, but two known federal agents that could wipe her out, and it's 4 years since her kidnapping. I sent a letter to Reverend Dumke to give to Patty Hearst, and I think that this week I'll send a copy of this letter to the Pleasant Prison, too, Pleasant, California, because the way that I was able to keep Robert Hyde alive when he was scheduled for psychosurgery in Vacaville, the same prison where Donald DeFries was given the mind control job by CIA agent Colston Westbrook to be told he'd be a great leader. I called up the warden there, and many of you know the story, and said, don't you dare touch his brains, and that I would sue them, and that they were going to do this mind job surgically on Robert Hyde. And then when he was moved to Folsom, I called the warden there, and I called the warden down in Chino. I have a habit of doing that because when I get there and threaten a lawsuit, a letter can be put into the wastebasket, but it's more effective. And you might try it if you have loved ones that you think are being ripped off, or if there's a prison situation where you think a person's life is in danger. Pick up the phone and call the warden. I've never read anywhere that anybody else has done that. And I know at Folsom, when I talked to the warden, he told several people there he thought I was on drugs or out of my mind to do such a thing. And then when Robert Hyde left Folsom and was sent back to Soledad and then later just released from the prison, the warden called him in and said, you really have a friend in May Bressel. And he said, I know it. And he said, she went to bat for you and spoke up. And I wasn't a relative of any kind, but I did go to bat. And Patty has to be very careful because the Harrises have asked, Leonard Wineglass as the attorney and Emily William Harris have asked for Patty to have a psychiatric test before she testifies against them, and to suggest that she is mentally sick after going to school, keeping up her grades, keeping house, leading a perfectly, in quotes, normal childhood with no instance of mental disease or depression or symptom of any kind. And then she's put in the trunk of a car in a garbage can and taken into a closet for 54 days and then trained to use a gun and then told to front for them and stand in front of a microphone and a camera and say, I'm Tanya, and identify herself and become a federal criminal within weeks after she's confined in a closet. They want her mind challenged to testify against them. If the SLA were a legitimate group and they needed money to continue doing their Robin Hood operations of feeding the poor and taking from the rich and stealing from the Hibernia Bank, which was owned and run by Patty Hearst's best friend, her grandfather, he just passed away several weeks ago. She knew the family that had the bank and was familiar with them, and so in she walks with her machine gun. And if they were legitimate, they would secretly go and rob wherever they could to keep the thing going as long as they could. I don't know people that ask the FBI to chase their ass by standing in front of a camera if they're so clever, and they were all college graduates just about, except Donald DeFries. All of them were very educated. They just simply smashed the camera, one of them wearing a mask, or try to, and this way they said, stand in front of the camera and tell them who you are, not who they were. And they turned into a federal criminal on top of being in a closet all this time and never have handled the weapon before. So Patty becomes a criminal after being in this condition of guilt and fear and drugged and so forth. And Nancy Ling Perry did work with the intelligence community, and I spoke to a prisoner who knew the family in Oakland, and she had been in Washington and had been in a drug program as Emily William Harris worked with the DEA. These were the allegations. I say of Alex Bottos, who was in Illinois and Indiana and did work there. So, Patty, they want her to have her mind tested. And this is very important because they must know that she's going to be incoherent or crazy. So you have to, if they're going to use a defense of Patty's mind isn't right. And if Patty in this last couple of weeks has given interviews that show she's pretty much on top of things, of just who Charlie Bates and the FBI were, why she was picked because of her family, how the government was involved, then the only choice that the Harrises have against a lifetime in prison possibly would be the incoherence of Patty to testify against them because she's the only one around, or make her crazy so that she's not believable to the jury. Now, how do you protect her so that she doesn't appear crazy? One, these are the suggestions I gave to Reverend Dunphy to pass on to her, and which I also must pass immediately on to the prison. One, that she should take this advice and listen very carefully, that she should not leave any drink of water or Coke and walk away and come back. I don't know how the cells are open or how much traffic flow there is at Pleasant. It's supposed to be pretty loose, the loosest of the prisons, but that has its disadvantages. If she were in a place as tight as the women's equivalent, say, to Folsom or Soledad, and she just stayed in her own cell, she'd survive the trial if she had her own food in her own cell. But when it's loose, if she walks away and leaves something and comes back to it, the CIA has this tasteless substance that can be deposited in something that she drinks, and from that moment she can get silly and lose her mind or get destructive or get violent or suicidal and turn against herself and become almost autistic and not remember. Memories can be erased, and goodness knows the CIA has a list of goodies. Read Operation Mind Control if you want to read the choices of what they have to slip in. They also put into the prison prisoners who are agents. Lewis Tackwood went to Soledad working for the Los Angeles Police Department. He gets on a bus with other men that have been convicted and sentenced, and they say, what's your rap? Assault, what's your rap? Forgery. And he can complain and bitch, and they use agent provocateurs who've already been in prison, so they know the lingo. And you accept them as underdogs, and so that she can be in with other women, in addition to Squeaky Fromm and Sandra Good, who are agent provocateurs, who can slip something to her if she leaves anything open. And she should only take from, say, a running tap and not take anything that's open. If she drinks something, leave what she doesn't want and never go back to it, and don't have a glass of water or coffee or tea at the table, and get up and get some ketchup and come back to your table. Just forget it. Eat what's on your plate. I do that when I travel and meet with people that I don't know, or have appointments. People want to see me, and I don't meet them the first time at the house. We go down to a place like the Thunderbird here in town, a bookstore, restaurant. But I don't get up and go to the ladies' room or look at a book or go back for anything at the counter and then come back. Once I have something, I either eat it or drink it or leave it, and that's true inside the prison. Also, she shouldn't take any medication before the trial. If the doctors that she has are not CIA doctors, Dr. Jolly West was her psychiatrist, if they can trust the family doctor, Reverend Dunphy, I trust, if she has any sickness at all, if she cuts her finger, she shouldn't get a shot. You know, if she has any toothache, be careful. Don't get any fillings or anything taken care of until after the trial, until she's out. CIA agents don't go to public dentists and doctors, and she, in turn, shouldn't go within the prison system. She should be allowed the privilege of her own doctor, a special doctor, in lieu of the fact that it can be proven that people inside the prison are given things to make them drowsy. I went to the trial of Hugo Pinnell out in Salinas, and he was charged with killing a prison guard, and he was in his cell, and the guard was outside the cell, and the guard died at Fort Ord Hospital, and Hugo was innocent of this crime that he's still serving time for. But he fell asleep at his trial. Can you imagine how boring it is to be charged with murdering a prison guard, and you're so incoherent and bumbling that you fall asleep? And Hugo kept saying that there was something in his food, and he was drowsy. And he got an easy conviction. He couldn't even put up a good defense. And the lawyer was put on the case just the weekend before the trial. They switched lawyers. They wouldn't hold over for the lawyer that had done the work, but he was drowsy. Patty's working in the kitchen from 11 to 5, something like that, I believe, helping stir food and cook food in the prison system. That's her work job. But I don't think that the breakfast or lunch that's brought to her, she should have. I think that the Hearst should bring in their own fruit and vegetable, and again, on the basis of poisoning people inside the prison, because the prison system has a past record, and if Randolph Hearst doesn't believe me, I can introduce him to Lewis Tacwin and Robert Hyde, two people who are now outside, one who did this kind of thing on other people and one who was a victim, and demand that this thing stop and that Patty can continuously be treated the way that Robert Hyde and others. I'm just singling out two specifically that I became very close personal friends with, but there are many people who have corresponded with me, and I have records of their trials. Another thing is that she shouldn't take cigarettes from any person. She smokes cigarettes. I'm going into length with you on what the advice I gave Patty Hearst, because you can pass this on to other people you know in prison, or you can incorporate it into letters that you write to public officials. When somebody goes crazy or a senseless murder or they go berserk for no reason, this PCP, this angel dust that causes instant insanity for some people, or acid, certain types of acids, are injected into cigarettes. There are things other than just straight the tobacco in cigarettes, and the cigarette can be packed with this kind of chemical. I've been reading a lot about that. So you don't take cigarettes from strangers. You get them from a vending machine. And again, if you don't keep the pack in your pocket the whole time, don't run out. If she's in the kitchen, she shouldn't ask somebody for a cigarette because she doesn't have a pack. You don't accept food or drink or cigarettes, anything that you put into your mind or body. And I wouldn't, she said she doesn't watch television. I wouldn't even watch that. There was a man that was wanted on a crime, and they flashed with permission of the federal government, federal communications on the screen, go to the chief, go to the boss or the feds, hoping that he'd see the program and would get this subliminal suggestion of what to do. Well, what about all the other people that weren't supposed to see the message? Did they see it too? I mean, was everyone running in to turn themselves in or getting some kind of a message of behavior or direction? And so long as directions are given on screens, is this paranoid? I don't think so. I think in lieu of the fact that Patty is in a prison and has to testify against two hard-assed, cold, cruel prisoners that she didn't trust or like at any time, and she had no way of knowing their links to the intelligence world or to the Scots, no, I don't think it's cruel to go into the possibility that she can be done in order for the Harrises to get out. The only thing standing between Patty Hearst and her life and her freedom for the time being is the way she handles the case with the Harrises and stays alive and keeps her mind clear. And it's very important to follow these rules. And as I say, I went at length with you because some people don't realize the danger, the precarious position that she's in. And many of you know, of course, that the federal government is very capable of doing this to protect their own agents. And I believe the Harrises are agents of the federal government. The strongest link of the SLA to the CIA broke in 1975 and 76, and it has to do with a man named Michael Casey. And I'm going to go into this now and a part of next week's tape, too, because I don't have time for it on just one part of this tape, but I don't want to leave it off for you just dangling. So what we don't complete here, I will go into with you next week. There was an article in the Los Angeles Times in 1975 about a man named Michael Casey. And he had been at Soledad Prison, and he had worked at Boys Town prior to that. He served 2 years in Soledad Prison, and I'm not sure exactly if he wasn't an agent provocateur, similar to Lewis Tacwood, who was up there also at one time, because he worked with the intelligence community before, and he worked with the intelligence community afterwards, and then his charges were dropped against him, and Michael Casey was there just prior to when Lewis to when Donald DeFreeze was put into Soledad. He had left by the time DeFreeze was there, but I'm not sure how much influence he had in Soledad. He had been in Southeast Asia during the My Lai, and he was a newspaper correspondent at the time, and then he came home and he was hired for at Boys Town, I guess that's the one in Omaha, Nebraska, where he became, in quotes, the director for special projects, whatever that is, for Boys Town Administration, and he worked there 9 months, and he took with him 31 confidential files of men from Boys Town, or in quotes, boys, which may be the groundwork of a nucleus like Hitler's youth of men that they could use in and out of the prisons or on the streets as future agents. He took these files with him, and he was convicted for forgery and put inside Soledad, and then later he was released. And in March 14th, 1975, Michael Casey shows up and says to Randolph Hearst, he gets Randolph Hearst's phone number in New York City, and he said he had information about Patty Hearst, that she was in Southeast Asia. Now, he used the Southeast Asia hoax as a way to get money to go over to Hong Kong. I'm sure he had money anyway. The Los Angeles Times sent him over there. And he went under the conduit. He had been working for Time Magazine, another strong conduit of the Central Intelligence Agency. And his excuse was to find Patty. Now, they were looking for Patty in 1975, and this was a wonderful way to spread what I wrote in 1974 to make the SLA international, to reach out overseas and link it maybe with the Biedermannhof or the Japanese Red Army or the PLO. If Patty were over on another continent disguised, then the Interpol would get into it, the international police with their great data banks, and it would be bigger than the FBI and the CIA, and then would get into the Interpol. So Michael Casey had contacted the Hearst people and seemed to have information about Patty that nobody else would have, which is logical if he were in the intelligence community. So he goes to Southeast Asia, and this is in 1975, and with him he had the credits for Time magazine. Now, the Henry Luce connections to the political assassinations, the FBI, the counterintelligence program, are a whole cassette I can do for you by itself. But he carried these credentials of the loose organization of Time magazine. Whitaker Chambers worked for Time magazine. Robert Kaiser, who was with Sirhan Sirhan when even the FBI and nobody else could be with him, knew Claire Luce and worked for Time magazine. He wrote RFK Must Die, a brainwash cover job on Sirhan Sirhan. Michael Casey had credentials of Time magazine, and went over to Southeast Asia on the fluke that he was going to find Patty Hearst. But he didn't find Patty Hearst. He came home, and there was a long article in the Los Angeles Times, and he came home and he worked with the Vietnamese that were brought to this country. He took a woman, Mrs. Trout, a Los Angeles Times reporter who worked with the Hearst team, down to Casey took them to Camp Pendleton to see the Vietnamese refugees that were high in the Phoenix program. And I compared the SLA to the Phoenix program coming home to the United States, and that Phoenix agents such as Colston Westbrook, who worked with the CIA in Southeast Asia and Tokyo and mind control, had set up the SLA, the nucleus of the SLA. So Michael Casey was down with the Vietnamese Phoenix operators down in Camp Pendleton with a Time magazine credentials with Randolph Hearst's phone number, and he took a woman from the Hearst organization down there, and they had the proper credentials and clearance to visit the Vietnamese premier, Ky, former South Vietnamese the premier, and Casey's credibilities were good. He'd been in Boys Town, he worked for Time, he'd gone to Southeast Asia, he knew Premier Ky, he'd been in Vietnam before, and he took this trip allegedly to Hong Kong in 1975 to find Patricia Hearst. But what he came home with was something much greater than just Patty Hearst, who wasn't there at all, and the Pentagon knew it. He got something like $15,000 for the trip and salary and telephone calls and expenses and credentials. And he said he worked for NBC in Vietnam at one time. NBC denied that, but of course John Mitchell and Richard Nixon denied that they knew anything about Watergate, and so did E. Howard Hunt. So they're trained, the CIA, for denial, so that's not important. And Michael Casey also said that in the United States, Senator John Tunney had intervened with Governor Ronald Reagan to get his parole from prison. And of course Ronald Reagan denied that, but Michael Casey, a short time, was in Soledad, but sandwiched in between that, as I say, worked at Boys Town, which has been identified with intelligence operations. He had important files from Boys Town. He was with the My Lai Massacre Group, and then he was back in Hong Kong and Camp Pendleton with Premier Ky. He had the time credentials and said he worked with NBC. So Michael Casey isn't any great slouch, and he contacts Randolph Hearst, I'm going to Asia to find Patty. Well, he didn't find Patty, but one of the biggest stories in the country broke shortly afterwards, and it was suppressed by the New York Times. The biggest story came in the Washington Post, and I'll give you the date, September the 16th, 1976. That was just 2 years ago. This is the anniversary of this story. And there was one little article in came over the UPI for general newspapers. That this is the way the first small article on the UPI came. It said, the Justice Department is investigating the loss of a top-secret notebook belonging to Leo Chern, chairman of the President's Foreign Advisory Board. Leo Chern was a member of President Ford's Intelligence Oversight Committee. He had gone with Commander Lionel Olmar, O-L-M-E-R, a Navy career man of 19 years, to Europe. Leo Chern had gone, and he had been head of the International Rescue Committee, which was instrumental in bringing Lee and Marina Oswald to this country. It's a violently anti-communist CIA front, and he was on the intelligence board. And in 1975, Leo Chern took a trip to Europe with one of the head Navy people and came home, and when they got home, they found out that the list of all their top agents in the Central Intelligence Agency, that their working list of agents was, in quotes, lost in Europe. The first story was that he lost it at some whorehouse, which he vehemently denied. But Leo Chern went to Europe in 1975 and with a top 19-year-old man of Navy intelligence representing Gerald Ford and his intelligence board. In 75, he goes to Europe and comes home and doesn't have his book. But Michael Casey, with the background I gave you, went to Southeast Asia at the same time that Chern was in Paris, and Michael Casey comes home with the book of the list of the intelligence agencies of the CIA, and then barters with Judge Carter and gets involved in the Patty Hearst case with the known list of agents that Michael Chern had. So two men take a trip in 1975 to Southeast Asia and Europe, both working at different parts of the world, but when he comes home in 1975, it surfaces in 76 that Casey is bartering and involved in the Patty Hearst case, and in his hands are the books that belong to Leo Chern and Mr. Olmar of the Navy. Now, this is pretty scandalous, and it's complicated because of the intelligence community links and how it affected Patty Hearst and then Judge Carter, and then Judge Carter died, and Judge Orrick took on the case and prosecuted Patty in that miserable trial. I will read to you parts of the September 16th, 1976 Washington Post story, Intelligence Advisor and the Green Book Affair. As I say, in February of 1976, just months prior, Gerald Ford had put Leo Chern on the Oversight Committee to watch the illegal actions of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA, and of course, I had accused the SLA operation of being a defense intelligence combined Tom Charles Houston operation with all intelligence operations. Leo Chern was head of the International Rescue Committee, the CIA front, long associated with CIA and CIA money. He was appointed by Gerald Ford, and then later had direct links to Patty Hearst, Randolph Hearst, after he lost his green book in Paris with the names of over 100 CIA intelligence agents. Now, this is important because with the names of Colston Westbrook, Willie Wolfe, Emily and William Harris, and people, Angela Atwood, Gary Atwood is still alive in Indiana. Angela's dead. He didn't even go to her funeral. The two of them were supposed to be agents together. He brought her to California and went back to Indiana. And when she was burned, he wasn't even interested in that cremated body that the Los Angeles Police Department burned. He could care less. Now, these people had all been to Europe. These agents, in fact, at the house, when the house burned down in Los Angeles, there was a passport book of William Harris. It doesn't say what countries he was in his army papers. And it doesn't say why a member of the SLA would be carrying army papers with him, or why they were in that house at the shootout, or where he was stationed in Vietnam, or did he in fact know any of the people in Vietnam that Michael Casey was visiting later at Camp Pendleton, or the Colson Westbrook knew in Vietnam. But a list of 100 intelligence agents were in this book, and the book was in the hands of Michael Casey when he came home from Southeast Asia. I'll continue with this next week because, unfortunately, we're out of it. You'll have to pick it up on the next tape next week. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California.